Upcoming public lectures are available at www.law.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. This is our number two, Focus 580. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. This is our morning talk program. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will return to a subject that we've discussed here before, certainly many times on the program. We like to touch on it from time to time, and that is Russia, Russian politics and current events there. Certainly we'll be talking this morning about recent elections. We'll be talking about the country's leader, Vladimir Putin, who is due to step down from the presidency next year. And I'm sure we'll be talking about his continuing role in Russian politics. And our guests for all of this morning, in this hour of the show, is Michael McFaul. He is the director of the Center on Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. He's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's professor of political science at Stanford and is also the deputy director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. He is, in addition, a non-resident senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of a number of books about Russia and Russian politics and frequently comments in the national media on American foreign policy and international politics. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. We just ask people to try and be brief, and we ask that so we can get in as many callers as possible and try to keep things moving along. But certainly, questions from people who are listening are welcome. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor McFaul, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Okay.
People here, I'm sure, will know that Time Magazine, as it does every year, has been for a long time now, has selected its Person of the Year, and their choice for Person of the Year this time around is the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin. And I think that also the folks at Time, in talking about this, have tried to make it clear, make sure everybody understands that this choice is based on looking around the world and looking at individuals who are very powerful players on the world stage.
Right.
And so in their judgment now, they've said maybe now one of the most powerful players on the world stage is indeed Vladimir Putin. What is it that puts him in this position? What makes him that powerful and influential?
Well, I have read the Time endorsement very closely, and I appreciate all their qualifying language about we're not choosing the best person in the world, we're choosing the most influential. When you read it, though, and you see what they attribute to him, I think they've actually got their analysis very wrong. Hmm. And what makes Russia a great country today or a powerful player today has something to do with Putin, but a lot to do with oil prices. And when you read the analysis and say that, you know, Putin put Russia back on the map, that's just not my reading of recent Russian economic history. It had a lot to do with the financial crisis back in 1998, which really shook up the economy before and forced the Russian government to do a lot of very important reforms that they didn't want to do in the early 1990s. And so the Russian economy actually started growing 18 months before Vladimir Putin showed up. And then right around the time he became president, oil went from $10 a barrel to $90 a barrel. And Russia, being one of the largest exporters of oil and gas in the world, has benefited tremendously from that. So I would say he's a bit of an accidental president, showed up at the right time in the right place, and that's what made Russia important today, not necessarily anything that Mr. Putin himself has done.
Mm-hmm. Well, even in the piece, and I had a chance to look at it, I think that they also raise this question of his origins and his success, and say that if you take a look at where it was he came from, you would have to say that it would seem unlikely that this man would rise to the top of the Russian leadership.
Yeah, his rise has been remarkable, and you know that I think is a positive attribute. Again, accidental, right? The first time he ran for elected office, he ran for president of Russia. Imagine that in any established democracy. That just doesn't happen. And it happened for a very simple reason, that Boris Yeltsin, the previous president, chose him very explicitly because he thought that he would be the guy that would continue with Yeltsin's legacy and, in particular, would not mess around with the property rights of Boris Yeltsin and his family. It wasn't because he was a great governor out in Siberia. It wasn't because he was a proven bureaucrat. It was simply because of that very fact.
Well, you can say on the one hand that Russia is in a stronger position now than it was even a few years ago, and that has to do clearly with its natural resources. So it's, if nothing else, people talk about it as being a natural resource superpower. So that's on the one hand, and apparently a number of people in Russia have become incredibly wealthy, and even people who are on the lower end of the income scale have seen some improvement in their standard of living. So you can say that it's stronger in that sense. There are also, of course, people continue to raise concerns about the way he governs in his authoritarian and anti-democratic manner. So if you know, ask this question, well, where does Russia stand today? And how people in Russia think about him, I guess one wonders, well, how do you balance off improvement in standard of living, which is there, and in some sense, what seems to be this tendency to almost take the country backwards, at least in terms of democratization. How does one balance those two things? And I wonder actually how most Russians balance those two things.
Right. Excellent question. And they're two very different questions, importantly, right? How does one as an analyst like me versus how do the Russians? Let's start with Ivan Ivanovich in Russia. And I do survey work in Russia and followed this for many years. It's a pretty clear story, right? When the economy is getting better, people like who's ever in power. And that is a law of electoral politics that we see generally throughout the world in democracies, right? It most certainly happens in our country. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago is a phrase that politicians use. And if you're the incumbent, you want to use that phrase. And if times are good, and if you're a challenger in times are bad, that's the phrase you use, right? So I think Putin would be popular no matter what he was doing on the democratic side, because of that simple fact that the economy is growing, even if it has very little to do with any policies that he himself did, right? I mean, Bill Clinton got a lot of credit in the 1990s for turning the economy around. I live here in the Silicon Valley, and I know that many of my friends working at major new companies here would say, hey, you know, maybe we had a little to do with that turnaround, but that doesn't matter. That's how it works in electoral politics. So for most Russians, the 1990s was a terrible time. It was a time of economic depression on a scale much larger than, say, the American Depression in the 1930s. It was a time of uncertainty. You were going from a command economy to a market economy, one-party state to a quasi-democracy, and you were redefining the borders of the state, right? I mean, they went from the Soviet Union to Russia. All three of those things happened simultaneously. And, you know, that's a revolution by my definition, and it's interesting to analyze from afar. It's not a fun thing to live through. So Putin came along, and because of these combination of these reforms that took place and the oil prices, the economy began to turn around, and he said, I'm the guy that's going to end the revolution, right? The Thermidor, as the phrase that came from the French Revolution. That's what he's done, and people, there was a demand for that, and it would have happened if it was Putin or a liberal or a communist. It wouldn't have mattered. That was the moment that was ripe, and therefore he gets the credit for it. And so 70-75% of Russians support him.
And that's something that I wanted to ask you about, because certainly his approval ratings seem to be quite high. I'm sure that there are many leaders around the world that would be thrilled to have that kind of approval rating. His party in recent elections, his party was extremely successful. Having said that, though, do we trust those kind of numbers? I mean, can we indeed have faith that when it says that he has that kind of over 70% approval rating, that that is in fact accurate?
I think it's generally accurate. I mean, there's one independent polling organization left in Russia, and their numbers are a little bit lower than that. So I think it's generally accurate. But I think to understand those numbers, in addition to the things we were just talking about the turnaround of the economy and giving Putin credit, you also have to factor in that there is no longer any independent media that reaches on a national level inside Russia. So there's no criticism of Mr. Putin on national television at all. And we do know from surveys that I think it's like 93 to 95% of Russians get their political news from national television. Second, there's no ability for opposition candidates to have any voice on the national scene as well, right? So I'm sure Mr. Bush, for instance, would love it if all the national media did what the White House told him to do, and that he didn't have to face, you know, criticism from a Democratic Party or presidential candidates on the Democratic side criticizing him. His numbers would probably be higher in those circumstances as well.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Michael McFaul. He's professor of political science at Stanford University, where he is also director of the Center on Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law at Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. And he has been following Russian politics for a long time, has authored a number of books about Russia, and frequently comments on American foreign policy in print and broadcast. We're talking this morning about Russia. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure, as probably most people know by this point, that the president of Russia is term limited by the constitutions, and so we've known some time now that if nothing changed, that Mr. Putin would have to step down from the presidency next year. And for a long time, there was a lot of speculation about what would happen. Would he do that? Would he engineer some kind of change in the Constitution? Could he find some sort of a way to step out for a little while and then to step back? And at least according to what I have read recently, it looks like none of that's going to happen, that what he is planning to do based on the electoral strength of his party is that he is planning to become the prime minister, a position that in the past had not been particularly powerful. But and I don't think anybody expected after he stepped down for the presidency, he was just going to retire to his dacha and take up fly fishing. Do we expect now that no matter what it is, what kind of job Mr. Putin has, that he will continue to be probably the most important person in Russian politics for some time now to come?
I think so, at least in the short term. And I have to say that I, too, was surprised by the formula by which he came up with to maintain his position of power. The gentleman that he chose to be president of Russia, and I emphasize that Putin chose him, right? The voters will go to the polling booths in 4 months, but everybody already has concluded that Mr. Medvedev will be the president of Russia. Medvedev is a young guy who's worked for Putin for 17 years as an aide. He, too, has never run for elected office before this upcoming election. If you were trying to pick somebody that would be a loyal lieutenant and a loyal successor to Putin, this is your guy. And so that's the way it looks like Putin has orchestrated. But the second thing he did was he did agree to become prime minister. And I think it's a gamble myself. And here's why. Because there's no Teflon prime ministers. If you look at Putin's numbers as president, it's always hovered around 70%. And you look at the numbers for the prime minister and the government, that is those people responsible for the economy, it's always been between 20 and sometimes as many as 35 points lower than the president. Because Russians tend to blame the government for economic problems, not the president himself. And so I think it's going to be much more challenging for Putin to be the prime minister and show up every day and have to be responsible for a lot of, you know, the basic bread and butter issues. And without, and this is an important distinction in the Russian Constitution, without being responsible for foreign policy or the defense ministry or the intelligence services, because those ministries all report directly to the president. So in other words, he's got the social issues and he's got the economic issues as prime minister. He doesn't have those more, portfolios that he likes, Mr. Putin, and there's no doubt about it. He much prefers to be doing foreign policy than economic policy. So over time, I'm not so sure this formula is going to work, and that's led some in Moscow to speculate that it's a short-term formula and that we might, in fact, see Putin back in the Kremlin sometime soon.
And that, do you think that that's at least a plausible kind of scenario?
I think it's plausible, but I have to say, you know, 2 weeks ago when I was in Russia doing various commentary during the elections, I said I'd be very surprised to see Mr. Medvedev as the presidential candidate, and then he was chosen. And then I said it would be, of all the positions that Putin could take, being prime minister seems like a rather unlikely one, and then he's accepted that. So I've given up trying to read Mr. Putin's mind.
That's the problem with trying to predict the future. Yeah. You know, invariably, you get proven wrong. Well, we have a caller to bring in. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Urbana. This would be our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to maybe focus on some longer-term problems that Russia might experience even beyond the point that the oil begins to run out. The population decline has been a serious problem, as you're well aware, in Russia for the past several decades. And during the communist era, there are estimates that the Muslims would outstrip the growth rate of the Russians. And there had been some efforts to turn that around in terms of increasing population. I'm not sure how successful they've been. And the second aspect of the demographic problem is has to deal with the brain drain. There have been a lot of Russian emigres coming into the States and other countries in Western Europe since the collapse of communism, and that trend may continue. And I was just wondering what the kind of status of the Russian brain power, if you want to call it that, the educational system is today with this continued flow of Russians out of the country, especially educated Russians, and what this portends for a kind of a viable state well into the future.
It's an excellent question. I would say it's Putin's number one challenge as Russia's president, and he's actually made that quite clear in various speeches. Both the demographics and dealing with the brain drain. First on the demographics, Russia's at 148 million, I think, this year. Some projections say in 50 years Russia will be down to 100 million if they don't turn this around. So it's a giant problem. One, just to maintain the growth rates that they have right now, about 6.5%, almost 7% probably this year. They need that workforce, and their workforce, just like the rest of Europe, is older and retirement. Those on retirement and pensions is growing as a percentage of the population. Okay. Second challenge is that Russia is losing people, but on its border so out in the east is China, which is exploding. And if you look very precisely at the border between Russia and China in some provinces, you'll see 2 million Russians in a giant province, say, you know, the size of Montana or Nevada, and then on the other side will be a much smaller Chinese province. On the Russian side, there'll be 2 million people. On the Chinese side, there'll be 170 million people. And how to manage that border and illegal immigration is a giant, giant security challenge for Russia. And they haven't figured it out. Putin has put in place policies to encourage women to have more children. So far, the data, I think, shows that it's not having much of an effect. And really, the only way they're going to be able to address this is to have more liberal immigration policies. But they're worried about that for some of the reasons the caller hinted at, because a lot of the countries that people would come from on the borders of Russia are have Muslim populations that security folks in the Kremlin think is a threat to their national culture. On the second part of the caller's question, the brain drain, it's been fantastically negative for Russia over the last 15 years. This is a country, after all, that produced and still does produce more PhDs in math and physics than any country in the world, including the United States. So when the borders were open, those people naturally went to places that would pay them the best dollar. And here where I live, I think Russian now is the third most popular language in the Silicon Valley. And Putin also understands this. He understands that to lose this asset and just to become an oil and gas exporting country would be a big tragedy for Russia's long-term economic growth. What he doesn't understand, I think, is that to do that, you have to have a freer society, right? You just can't dictate from the top, I hereby decree we're going to make the next Google. That's not the way it works. And so you can do that in the oil and gas sector, right? I mean, it doesn't take much to own and those companies and seize those companies, as he's done, and then pump the oil and gas abroad. But other kinds of economies, more knowledge-based economies, take competition, take a more free market approach, and that is fundamentally not Putin's orientation so far.
Can I ask a quick follow-up
question?
Yeah, sure. A comment on that. You know, one of the founders of Google is a Russian emigre,
yep.
Sergey Brin, who actually worked in Champaign for a while.
That's right, of course.
And the other question is, there are a number of Western companies, Cisco, Intel, and others, that have tried to set up kind of research units in Russia to kind of tap into the brain power there. And I was just wondering if you have any information about, since you're out there in Stanford, about the success or limitations of some of these efforts to harness Russian brain power on Russian soil.
Yeah, I would say every major company here in Silicon Valley now has a lab of some sort in Russia today. And it's the model is very simple. They use engineers in Russia and programmers in Russia and aerospace engineers, too. Boeing has a very big operation in Russia to do technical work over there. And it's, you know, obviously still much cheaper to hire that labor over there than here. What you don't see yet in Russia, there's a couple of companies, so I shouldn't overgeneralize, but you don't yet see a kind of indigenous Russian high-tech industry in and of itself. And that's what they want. That's what they aspire to do, because they understand that that's where they get more value added over the long term, rather than just as a place to do outsourcing work for companies here in the West.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Michael McFaul. He's professor of political science at Stanford University, where he is also director of the Center on Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law at Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. He has been writing about Russia for quite a long time now. He's author of a number of books about Russia and Russian politics, and often comments on the national media here in the United States on things like American foreign policy and international politics. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here to talk with, someone in Champaign, and this is our line number one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. It seems to me that Putin manipulates things and then puts a semi-democratic veneer on them. So if that's the case, what's to prevent him from redefining the roles of president and prime minister?
Two excellent points. He most certainly manipulates things and then calls them democratic. And they've gone through various stages, by the way. They used to call it managed democracy. The phrase these days is called a sovereign democracy, and the reason they put the emphasis on sovereign is that they don't want outsiders to be meddling in their internal affairs. But it's not democracy. It's autocracy disguised as democracy. So the formal institutions of democracy are still in place, you know, elections, a constitution, a parliament. But in reality, the checks and balances that go with a democracy and the kind of minimalist conditions for a free and fair elections are not in place in Russia anymore. So he has the power to do what he wants. Now, but the caller raises a really interesting question. If he has that power, why hasn't he changed the Constitution in the past? And in particular, the thing that's surprised me is that it would have been very easy for him, given that he controls the parliament, he controls the governors now, which used to be elected but now are appointed by him. He controls all these various parts of the government that have power to change the Constitution. And I think it would have been very easy for him to just say, okay, let's change the Constitution and allow me to serve as a third term as president. And he didn't do that, and that's curious to me. And, you know, I've talked to lots of people as to why, and one of the most intriguing things I heard was from a Kremlin official just a couple weeks ago when I asked him this question, and he said, look, he gave his word to his fellow KGB comrades. Mr. Putin, of course, began his career in the KGB for 20 years, and many of his senior associates now in the government are also former KGB, if there is such a thing as former officials from that institution. And he said, look, he gave his word to these guys, and when you give your word, that's an important thing in their KGB culture, and that's why he's stepping down. I don't know. But in the long run, I think the caller raises an important point, that, and I think it is Putin's aspiration, that over time, he thinks that perhaps the prime minister's office will become more powerful. And, by the way, he can do that even without changing the Constitution. That might just happen through a kind of organic shift of power where everybody understands that the White House, as it's called, that's where the prime minister sits in Moscow, becomes the new center of gravity rather than the Kremlin.
I suppose one might wonder whether his interest in maintaining the things as they are, that is, not changing the Constitution and stepping down, as it says, and moving into a different kind of political position, one might wonder, well, is this at all shaped by his interest in or his concern at how he might be regarded elsewhere in the world by other leaders? Does he care what people in other countries think?
Yes, he most certainly cares, and he's got a bit of a complex about it, I would say. So some people say he doesn't care, he just does what he wants. That I totally disagree with. If that were the case, they wouldn't be putting in millions of dollars to hire public relations firms in Washington and London and other places to work on Russia's image and Putin's image in the West. So they definitely care. But he also feels, you know, I haven't talked to him about this personally, but listening to what he said, I think he also feels kind of dissed by the West and that he doesn't get the respect that he deserves, in his opinion. And so you saw, particularly in this last parliamentary election, in my opinion, some of the harshest anti-American rhetoric that I've heard coming out of Russia. I think you have to go back 20 years, maybe even 25 years, to hear the same kind of really over-the-top anti-American rhetoric. If you were sitting in Russia and all you did was watch the national television as your source of news about international affairs, you would be led to believe that we here in the West, and Washington in particular, and Bush and Cheney, are spending every waking moment plotting how to weaken Russia, how to seize Central Asia and the Caucasus and Ukraine, as a way to surround Russia. I mean, it truly is over the top. And Putin himself on the campaign trail made it sound, he urged voters to come out and support him because we are at war with our enemies in the West who are seeking to destroy us. And so he's got this rather schizophrenic attitude, I think, towards the West. He wants respect. He doesn't feel like he's getting it. So then he says these rather over-the-top things, and his actions are you know, rather anti-Western in many respects in terms of the way that he has conducted Russian foreign policy.
Let us talk with some more people who are listening. Next, Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. What's your take on the murder of Litvinenko? It seems to me that high Soviet operatives were murdered Litvinenko, and they traced the radioactive element to a Soviet reactor. What's your take, sir?
Well, I'm not an expert on this. I trust the British authorities, and the British authorities wanted to bring Mr. Lugovoy, another KGB official from Russia. They think that he was, he is a prime suspect in the murder of Mr. Litvinenko, and Russia said no. Russia would not extradite him. And even more so, Mr. Litvinenko then ran in this latest parliamentary election as a member of the Liberal Democratic Party of Russia.
Lugovoy ran,
yeah.
Yes.
This is a party headed by a nationalist leader, Vladimir Zhirinovsky is his name, and Lugovoy won. So he's now a member of parliament, and that gives him immunity from all prosecution, Russian or otherwise. So that, to me, is just all highly suspicious. So without, you know, coming to conclusions, because I'm not an investigator, the way that Russia has gone about defending this guy makes one very suspicious.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to the next caller. This is also someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, yeah, hi, how are you? I don't envy your position. Russia is a very enigmatic country. I was going to ask you if you would comment on, with Kasparov, comes to the West, and Garrick, you know, the chess player, and talks extensively about the lack of democracy there or the joke. And I kind of think, in a way, the West, attitude because of Russia's supposed, you know, mineral wealth, which they seem to have a lot of, and sell a lot of gas to Europe, they sort of turn the other, you know, they just turn the, you know, turn away from their, like, sort of, I would say, you know, you're right, autocratic rule. But a couple of years ago, the publication Institutional Investor published an article by a Harvard grad who, it's titled How Harvard Lost Russia, mm-hmm. and it took place during, I mean, when Harvard sent a group of economist to Yeltsin's Russia, and it's a rather long and elaborate paper. It's about 50 pages long. But could you comment on that paper? And I'm sure you've read it, but would you comment on that?
Yeah, I'll comment on the paper and on Kasparov's comment, because I think they're related.
Okay.
So this paper that you're referring to is about the group of they weren't all from Harvard, but many were from Harvard, of advisors that went over in the 1990s to help Russia with its economic transition, and in particular with their privatization program. And to make a long story short, they made a lot of mistakes. And in particular, I would say, and I've written quite a bit about privatization before, in particular, the biggest mistake was not doing the privatization in a way that had political legitimacy. And that, therefore, made it easy when Mr. Putin came in to redistribute property yet again, because he could say, well, this was illegitimate, this was not fair, that a gentleman like Mr. Hartakovsky was given, you know, the richest oil company in Russia for next to nothing. And so that made it very easy to rewrite that. Now, to blame the Harvard economists is probably an overstatement. I think the Russians who were in charge, and Mr. Chubais in particular, who was in charge of those schemes, it was called Loans for Shares, is most responsible. But, you know, we were implicated in terms of being part of the problem. But then there's this larger narrative that you see now very predominant in Russia today, which is that the West came in the 90s, the Harvard advisors and Bill Clinton with his help to Boris Yeltsin. And the objective was not to help Russia become a market economy or a democracy, but to weaken Russia. And it's this conspiracy that that's what we were up to. Now, it's not true at all. And every country in the post-communist world had to experience some degree of an economic depression after 1989 in Eastern Europe and 1991 in the Soviet Union, because it just, there was lots of restructuring. You just can't go from a command economy to a market economy with no cost. There has to be some dislocation, and every single country went through it. So Russia is no different, and it wouldn't have mattered if there were Harvard economists or Stanford economists there. That would have happened. But that's not the story that's being told today to Russians. The story being told to them is that it's the Democrats, and they call them the Democrats, right? Yeltsin and Chubais and their friends in the West that destroyed Russia in the 90s, and we are now the ones that are restoring Russia. Even though Russia would not be as wealthy as it is today without those very difficult reforms of the 1990s. That's not on television. That part of the story is not out there. So now what happens to a guy like Garry Kasparov in Russia today? He, on Russian television, is being thrown in with those Democrats from the 1990s, the people that, have friends in the West but aren't friendly to Russia's national interest. I just saw Garry, in fact, 2 weeks ago in Moscow. And this is a very frustrating position to be in for a guy like him because, first of all, he had nothing to do with economic reforms in the 1990s. He was still focused on chess back then, not Russian politics. And second, his argument in Russia today is a very simple one. It's not about capitalism or socialism. In fact, he has many allies that, we would consider communists and or even, hardcore nationalists. His issue is a different one. It's just about the democratic rules of the game. Let's not, what one does in policy matters is a debate, but how we arrive at those policies should be through a democratic process. And he can't get that message out because of this longer narrative from the 1990s that makes it difficult for people to understand, small d Democrat from the so-called Democrats of the 1990s.
Yeah, hey, thanks. I really appreciate this, but I want to ask you to comment on one other thing. I've read recently in the last 2 years of the European press, I read a lot of European press, and they were talking about how there's a, really significant decline in the population of Russian males. I mean, the lifespan has actually decreased. I mean, I don't know if that's changed in the last couple of years or not. But I think, and you're right about Yeltsin, Putin represents a sort of new Russia, well, maybe old Russia, whatever, but a different Russia, let me put it that way. Could you comment on that? I mean, has that changed very much since then? I mean, the alcoholism rate and all that stuff. And thanks. I really appreciate your giving me a little more addition to that paper because I've sort of stuck in that paper for a couple of years. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the statistics in front of me right now, although I can tell you I have a new piece in a magazine called Foreign Affairs called The Myth of Putin's Success, where we go through the alcohol rates, the mortality rates, especially for men. And the bottom line story, though, is that these governance issues, right, the provision of public goods such as healthcare, and fighting alcoholism has not improved at all under the Putin era. And this, I think, may be one of the biggest myths about this current era, this notion that he's the guy that has restored stability and brought Russia back. Well, on very simple things like alcoholism rates, they're higher today under Putin than they were in this chaotic time in the 1990s. Mortality rates for men slightly got better at the end of the 90s, but have now been flat under Putin for the last 8 years. And that is a period of tremendous economic growth, by the way. You would think that things would be getting better. Percentage of the Russian budget spent on health care has actually gone down under Putin, not up. even though they were in economic depression in the 1990s, now they're, you know, they have more money than they know what to do with, and yet healthcare spending's gone down as a percentage of the budget. And even really raw things about order and stability, like murder rates. In the chaotic Yeltsin years, the murder rate was actually lower than it is today under Mr. Putin. So, you know, when you get into the data, it's hard to see, well, exactly why are we assigning all these good things to Mr. Putin? I think what's striking is, despite this incredible economic growth, the way that the Russian state governs is actually not much better than it was during the chaotic, anarchic years of the 1990s. Hmm.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Michael McFaul. He's professor of political science at Stanford University, has been following Russian politics for a long time. We have several callers. We'll see if we can get everybody in.
I'll be shorter.
All right. We'll go next to our line number three, and that is someone in Mahomet. Hello.
Yes. I'd like to ask you, and maybe you don't know, if you look at Russia and China and the EU versus the United States, I see the U.S. taking a big dive. Do you look at that at all?
Yeah, again, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there's no doubt about it. The United States is still the largest economy in the world, and then depending if you put the EU together, you have Japan, China. Well, EU would be ahead of that, but individual countries in Europe would not be. And then Russia, in terms of its size of its economy, depending on what exchange rate you use, is either 11th or maybe 13th in terms of ranking. And moving up, though. Russia's moving rapidly up. And people predict...
China.
Not as fast as China, still behind China considerably. But that's in the aggregate. If you look at GDP per capita, then Russia is considerably richer than China. And this is something I think people forget, that, you know, China's had fantastic growth for 30 years, right? About 10% a year
yeah.
for 30 years. But that the GDP per capita in China still, after all that growth, is only about $2,000 a year.
Yeah.
And that's because China started at a very, very low rate when it started its economic reforms. Russia is about three or four times that rate today. So Russia, as a place and as individuals, I think is a much wealthier country than China is today. But your point about long-term trajectories, I think, is also an important one, particularly with China, where there's no doubt about it that China will eventually catch the United States. Russia, I think that's a bigger question, because their economy's smaller, probably will never catch the United States.
Hmm. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to the next caller. This would be someone in Chicago on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to inquire about the situation in Russia regarding religious persecution. I understand that even after the revolution, it was still very difficult for the Catholic Church and other religions to operate there. What is the current condition at this time?
Difficult, but not repressive, would be my short answer. That is, there's no doubt about it that Mr. Putin favors the Russian Orthodox Church. He's made it clear that he's a believer, and their prominence in politics and money and has gone up tremendously in the last several years. But what has not happened, they did pass a very draconian law even before Mr. Putin. This is back in 1997 on different religious organizations, but they haven't really enforced it that much, and that's a good sign. And I think it leads to a more general point about Putin. Russians today are richer than they've ever been, I think, in their entire history, and I think that's a fact. Russia is also not a democracy today. That's also, I think, a fact. But the nuance that goes with that second statement is that individually, most Russians have enjoyed their individual civil liberties to a greater degree than they did, most certainly during the Soviet period and probably during the Tsarist period. So as long as you don't get involved in national politics, you have a lot of individual autonomy, including your religious beliefs.
Thank you very much.
All right, and to Urbana next for another caller. Line one, hello.
Hello. I've done some research into Sino-Russo relations, and I was wondering if you could comment on the challenge facing Russian leadership, well, specifically President Putin, with dealing with nationalism and xenophobia in the Russian Far East. I know at what point there was a great deal of tension between, I believe it was Putin and Governor Nazarenko, and I can't remember the Russian province that he was in charge of, maybe Primus Korkrai, but and how you would see that unfolding and affecting relations between China and Russia.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a really long-term question that will be, you know, for Russia, well after President Putin is out of power, will be their central foreign policy challenge moving forward. Mr. Nazarenko, the governor you mentioned, and he was the governor of Primorsky Krai, he's been removed several years ago, but he, when in power, was definitely using the nationalist card. And in particular, you know, the illegal immigration that comes in from the from China, but not only China, for Primorsky Krai, it's also Korea, you know, using nationalism. And there's no doubt about it that managing that is a big problem. And I would add to that Putin right now and his aides in the Kremlin, I think, are really playing with fire with this nationalist card, because they themselves are orchestrating it from above right now. There are these youth groups. One of them is called Nashi, which means ours. That is very organized, very xenophobic, very anti-American, and right now kind of controlled and manipulated from the Kremlin. But these are the kind of things that can spin out of control and have unintended consequences. And frankly, that scares me a lot. That the growing nationalism you feel in Russia is a problem not only in Russian-Chinese relations, but also in Russian-American relations.
Great. Thanks.
All right, thanks. Well, as a way of finishing up here, we have a couple of minutes. I'm interested in having you talk some more about Russian and American relations. Certainly, there seems to be a lot of concern in regards to this relationship and increasing tensions, and the fact that after the Cold War, it seemed that we had a period where relations between Russia and the United States really had improved. And now, certainly in the last couple of years, there we hear, and actually, I think what I have to say on both sides, there have been some rather belligerent things said.
Yeah.
What can you say about this relationship today, between the relationship between Russia and the United States?
Well, in general, it's in drift, would be the word I would use. And by that I mean in Washington and in the Bush administration, they just have not paid attention to this bilateral relationship for a long time. They have other foreign policy priorities, and as a result, there's growing indifference and then hostility that you've seen evolve in Moscow and among elites in particular about their relationship with the United States. And I guess I'd put it this way, that if you go back to the beginning of the Gorbachev period, when he was still General Secretary of the Soviet Union, and, you know, 1986, 1987, he embarked on a fundamental shift in Soviet foreign policy back then, where he made integration of the Soviet Union the central strategic objective of his foreign policy. And when Boris Yeltsin came to power in Russia as the first Russian president, he did this in an even more passionate way. Their idea was very simple. If we're part of the West, we're going to be better off than if we're on the outside of the West seeking to balance our power against them. Putin has ended that project. He now doesn't believe that integration is the way for Russia to go. Rather, he thinks Russia is strong enough and powerful enough and important enough to go it alone. And that, I think, is something we in the West haven't caught up with. We haven't caught up with the fact that they're no longer thinking about integration. And I think for the next president of the United States, he or she is going to have to come up with a different approach because we can't rely on Russia wanting to be part of the West as an assumption of our foreign policy.
Hmm. Well, are we going to, should we expect that we go back to a time when we're going to spend more time thinking about the ways in which our interests and their interests conflict rather than ways that they might overlap?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Which is not to say that we can't cooperate where our interests overlap, and we should seize those. And there are many issues: non-proliferation, fighting terrorism, reducing our nuclear arsenals. Where I think it's just a no-brainer that we should be cooperating, irrespective of what kind of government is in Russia and what kind of who is the president of the United States. But I do think we got to get used to the fact that Russia is seeing things in zero-sum terms, and we have to have a new approach to deal with that. And I would also just add one other thing. I don't think it's a coincidence that this kind of thinking in Russia is deepening at the same time that Russia is becoming more autocratic. I think there is a relationship between those two things. And the fact that we did not do enough in the 1990s to help consolidate democracy in Russia, I think is having negative strategic implications for the United States today.
Well, at that, we're going to have to finish up for this hour of the show. Our guest, Michael McFaul. He is professor of political science at Stanford University, where he is also director of the Center on Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law at Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. Professor McFaul, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Support for our show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. Tomorrow morning on the program in the 10 o'clock hour, we welcome back to the show David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Stops by once a month to talk a little bit about money management, personal finance, investing. If you have questions, you can call us. Then in the second hour, our guest is Nina Burley. She's a journalist. She works at People magazine. She's also adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia. And we'll be talking about the involvement of the French in Egypt in the time of Napoleon, subject of a new book that she's authored that's titled Mirage, Napoleon's Scientists and the Unveiling of Egypt. That's tomorrow, hour two. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics. Always welcome your questions, comments. Right now, we hope you'll stay tuned. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Again, hosting today is Jay Pierce.
That's right. Thank you very much, David, hosting the noon hour, and then we'll have an archived interview from Celeste in the 1 o'clock hour, and we do continue to wish Celeste a speedy recovery. And coming up in the noon hour, the usual assortment of news and information, of course, but first the update on the markets as per usual. And the March wheat contract in Kansas City is currently down 12.5 at 982.5. July is down 4 at 812.5. March wheat in Chicago, 960.5, down 13. May at 961, down 8. And July at 778.5, down 6.25. March corn, 436.25, up 1.5. May up 1.5 at 446.75. July at 454.75, up 2. December 08, 454.25, up 2.25. January soybeans, 1164.5, up 5.5. March, 1183, up 5.25. May, 1198.5, up 5.75. And November 08 soybeans, 1082, up 11.5. January soybean meal.